it won't be a traditionally fought election. It will be based on turnout. And whichever candidate can build a better list of people to turn out is going to be the one who wins.
U.S. Senate candidates court voters in rural Alaska. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Monday, September 22nd. Good evening. I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, a judge spells out changes the state needs to make for voters who speak Wichin and Yupik.
It's an extraordinary remedy, and we're really grateful. This is exactly what should have been occurring all along.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by Nana Regional Corporation and Tech Alaska, celebrating 25 years of resource development and partnership at the Red Dog Mine. And by BP Alaska, committed to the state of Alaska through investment, production, and jobs for future generations of Alaskans. More at alaska.bp.com.
A federal judge issued an order to the state of Alaska in a voting rights case today. In her 8-page order, U.S. District Court Judge Sharon Gleason said the state must take additional steps to provide voting materials to Alaska Natives with limited English. Corey Mills is a spokeswoman for the state of Alaska. She says the state is committed to doing everything that was put forth in the judge's order.
It's nice because the court gave us really clear guidance, and so with that clear guidance, we can put forth these additional tools to enhance the language assistance program in the state.
The lawsuit brought by several Native villages alleged that the state has failed to provide accurate, complete translations of voting materials in Yupik and Gwich'in. The state argued it had taken reasonable steps. Natalie Landreth is an attorney with the Native American Rights Fund, or NARF, who argued the case on behalf of the plaintiffs. She says the gist of the 21-point order is that the election information that English-speaking people are receiving must be made available in Yupik and its dialects and in Gwich'in. That includes all the radio announcements about deadlines that one would normally hear on the radio, information about all the ballot measures, and all the information about judges. Landreth says the order also mandates the entire official election pamphlet that is printed in English must be available in Yupik.
Not only that, but all of this information has to be reviewed and adjusted to make sure that it is understandable by all Yupik dialects, from Yukon to Hooper Bay Chivac down to Dillingham. So it's an extraordinary remedy, and we're really grateful that the court has taken the effort to order them to do this. This is exactly what should have been occurring all along.
All of this has to happen on a tight timeline before the November election. The order includes deadlines, some as early as this Friday. This year's U.S. Senate race in Alaska is shattering records for spending, with millions in outside dollars directed mostly toward TV ads. With less than 2 months before the general election, KYUK's Ben Matheson reports that both campaigns are also aggressively seeking an edge on the ground in rural Alaska.
In a Bethel subdivision not far from the Kuskokwim River, Barb Angayak is sacrificing this sunny Saturday for politics, and she's made a game plan.
Houses kind of down the hill, we'll hit that, come up here, get Gwynn's and this.
And Gaik is a volunteer canvasser working on behalf of Democratic candidates, including the Begich campaign. We visit the home of Letitia Gwynn.
What's up, Barb?
Hey, how are you?
I'm fine.
Good.
This door-to-door effort is a key part of Begich's strategy for reaching the rural vote. The campaign has 13 field offices across the state, double that of his efforts in 2008. They have staff in Bethel for the first time in decades, and the Alaska Democratic Party is advertising for part-time village-based staff. Max Crows is communications director for the Begich campaign.
That's a show of how committed he is to trying to win votes in rural Alaska and ask Alaskans in Bethel, the YK Delta, as well as across the state for their vote. And to have a conversation about the things that he has been able to do for rural Alaska.
The Begich campaign opened the field office well in advance of the August primary, which named former Attorney General and Natural Resources Commissioner Dan Sullivan as his Republican opponent. Sullivan recently hired a Nome woman, Megan Alvana Stimple, as their rural coordinator to formally ramp up their rural efforts. Ben Sparks, the campaign manager, says his candidate is taking the rural campaign seriously.
The Begich campaign has made it very clear that they feel as though they have the Alaska Native vote locked up, and nothing could be further from the truth.
Sullivan has 5 offices, but none in rural Alaska. But Sparks says they have tremendous support and organization in what they call super volunteers who reach out to their networks.
Our campaign is not going to rely on paid staffers. We are going to rely on prominent members of the Alaska Native community going and spreading Dan's message. And there's nothing more effective than that.
Both campaigns say nothing replaces having the candidates meet with voters in person. Begich visited in July to open his Bethel office and traveled downriver a few miles to the village of Nabuskiak. Sullivan has not made it in person, but his team says he will be here soon. The incumbent senator recently did the next best thing on KYUK's Friday Talk Line show.
Good morning.
How are you guys
today?
Good
morning, Senator. Good.
Well, good afternoon back here. Good morning to you.
Thank you. All right. Good afternoon.
Mark Trahant is an independent journalist who currently serves as the Atwood Chair of Journalism at the University of Alaska Anchorage and is writing extensively about the Alaska Native vote this year. He expects millennials, those voters roughly between the ages of 18 and 33, to be a pivotal force, and social media to play a big role in the Alaska Native vote.
It won't be a traditionally fought election. It will be based on turnout. And whichever candidate can build a better list of people to turn out is going to be the one who wins.
Back on the ground in Bethel, the front step conversation between Gwynn and Ngaiek isn't restricted to the future partisan makeup of the Senate.
I'm sure why your guys were coming over here, because I posted on Facebook that I had a hummingbird in my yard. So I've been having all these people come by.
Wow.
Where, Tish, what was it doing?
After an hour of door-to-door conversations, Ngaiek calls it a day.
There's something different happening this year. And that is this coordinated campaign, you know, helping with volunteers, making sure they know what to do, getting staff out and about to the communities is really, really important and impressive. I think it's really the way to go. It's a different way of running a campaign.
In a year in which she expects the election to come down to a minuscule number of votes, she plans to be out canvassing again soon. In Bethel, I'm Ben Matheson.
The state has filed an administrative complaint alleging unfair or deceptive practices by the vendor it hired to implement a new Medicaid payment system. The claim against Xerox State Healthcare LLC was filed with Alaska's Commissioner of Administration. It follows an unsuccessful attempt at mediation. It seeks compensatory, punitive, and other damages and an order requiring a plan from Xerox by October 15th to resolve problems with the system. The state, in its complaint, also reserves the right to go to court. The system has been plagued by problems since going live last year. The state said the department was aware of problems but believed Xerox assurances that the system was operational and there was a plan to resolve remaining issues. Xerox did not make anyone available for comment. The federal government has agreed to a deadline of the end of next year for an endangered species review for wolves in southeast Alaska. The Center for Biological Diversity, Greenpeace, and the Boat Company sued the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service this year, seeking a timely decision on their petition to list the Alexander Archipelago wolf under the Endangered Species Act. The groups filed that petition in 2011. The agency issued what's called a 90-day finding this March, committing to further review of the region's wolf numbers. Larry Edwards is a forest campaigner with Greenpeace in Sitka, and he notes the federal agency has not met timelines for reviewing the wolf petition.
The difficulty is that Congress doesn't adequately fund the Fish and Wildlife Service to process ESA listings. So when you go to court, it's really difficult even to get from a court a good date. So the Fish and Wildlife Service is looking at doing this in 2017, and I think we did fairly well to get this settled and get a date at the end of 2015.
In a settlement agreement filed this week, the federal government agrees to complete a 12-month finding on southeast wolves by the end of 2015. Andrea Medeiros, a spokeswoman for the Fish and Wildlife Service in Alaska.
At that time, we will announce whether or not we believe that it is warranted to list Alexander Archipelago wolf as threatened or endangered under the Endangered Species Act.
The petitioners want greater protection for wolves and their habitat on the Tongass National Forest. They argue that populations are declining and are vulnerable to hunting and trapping pressure, along with loss of habitat from logging on the 17 million acre national forest. In particular, they cite past and future logging on Prince of Wales Island and say wolves on Prince of Wales are in danger of extinction. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, a researcher looks for the key to sustainable Arctic communities.
One or two people who really have great idea for their community could really change everything around.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Ready to quit smoking, using e-cigarettes or other tobacco? Alaska's Tobacco Quitline can help with free, confidential coaching and support services through the telephone and online, and now introducing Text to Quit. Text to Quit helps you use medications correctly, manage urges, and prevent relapse, all from your mobile phone. Call 1-800-QUIT-NOW or visit AlaskaQuitline.com for more information. This message is sponsored by Alaska's Tobacco Prevention and Control Program.
A KTVA reporter announced that she is the president of the Alaska Cannabis Club and quit her job during a live broadcast last night. Reporter Charlo Green, whose real name is Charlene Egby, has been reporting on the legalization ballot initiative since April. KTVA's news director posted an apology for Green's outburst and use of an expletive on Facebook and Twitter, but could not be reached for comment. Green posted a video on YouTube explaining why she quit so publicly.
Advocating for freedom and fairness should be everyone's duty. I'm making it my life work to uphold what America stands for truly. Life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, ideals that now need to be defended.
The Vote No on Two campaigns spoke out against Green this afternoon. They say they spoke with KTVA's news director about her biased reporting after a five-part series that ran this spring. Kaylee Claysmat is the executive director of the Alaska Association of Chiefs of Police, which is opposed to legalizing marijuana. She says she also expressed concerns about Green's bias. She says Green's reporting has been a disservice to Alaskans.
When you have a reporter in a major news outlet as this one professing her own point of view in stories, it's really a very sad thing and difficult for the public to know what's true.
A YouTube video of the TV clip has gone viral, and Green's Indiegogo campaign to raise $5,000 for voter education on the marijuana legalization ballot initiative has nearly reached its goal. The Alaska Cannabis Club's website says its role is to connect medical marijuana cardholders who have pot with those who need it. More than 160,000 official public comments have been received by the EPA regarding their proposed restrictions on the controversial Pebble Mine, but it's expected that once the final numbers are tallied, there will be hundreds of thousands of comments, both pro and con. KDLG's Mike Mason has the story.
The deadline to submit comments on the EPA's proposed 404C action in Bristol Bay was Friday night. Eventually, all the comments will be available to read online, but that could take some time. At last count, the EPA had received over 160,000 comments, but that number is expected to be much higher once everything is received and counted. The organization Earthworks estimates the EPA has received about 700,000 comments in support of the proposed 404C action. Tim Bristol is the Alaska Program Director for Trout Unlimited, which has been one of the organizations that spent years lobbying for protections for Bristol Bay from the proposed Pebble Mine.
We've been overwhelmed by the number of positive comments that we've seen so far, particularly in the thing we're able to keep the best track of at this point. And, you know, we don't have definitive numbers, certainly, but the participation by Alaskans is clearly much larger this time around than previous comment periods. And so that's pretty exciting.
Now that the public comment period has come and gone, the next step in the process will be for the EPA to review the comments and for the administrator of Region 10 to either withdraw the proposed determination or put together a recommended determination. Initially, the regional administrator had 30 days to take either action, but last Thursday, the EPA issued a statement noting the agency believes that more time is necessary to adequately review and consider the thousands of comments received. To that end, the EPA has extended the time frame until no later than February the 4th of next year. The EPA's use of its 404C power before the start of the formal permitting process has drawn a lot of criticism in recent months. Rebecca Logan is the general manager for the Alaska Support Industry Alliance, which is made up of businesses, organizations, and individuals that serve the oil and gas and mining industries in Alaska. Logan confirms the alliance opposes the EPA's proposed 404C action and supports the Pebble Limited Partnership being allowed to move into the established NEPA permitting process. She also raises concerns that the EPA's action could be used to stop other resource development projects.
Now we're seeing it in two other states, people trying it there. And so, you know, they wouldn't be trying that if they didn't think other groups wouldn't be trying to do the exact same thing in other states to stop resource development if we didn't have what was happening here in Alaska happening. So I do think it's much broader.
It will likely take several weeks for the exact number of public comments to be tallied. In Dillingham, I'm Mike Mason.
A plane crash in Soldotna last summer resulted in the deaths of 10 people. The National Transportation Safety Board released its preliminary findings on the crash this week. KBBI's Shady Grove Oliver has more.
On July 7, 2013, a single-engine De Havilland Canada DHC-3 Otter crashed shortly after takeoff at the Soldotna Airport, killing all 9 passengers and the pilot. It was owned and operated by Radisky Air, an air charter company based in Nikiski. It was on its way to the Bear Mountain Lodge, about 90 miles southwest of Soldotna. Along with the two families, it was carrying luggage, food, bedding, and other supplies for the lodge. The National Transportation Safety Board, or NTSB, has been investigating the crash. Clint Johnson is the chief of the NTSB's Alaska Regional Office.
How we approach these accidents is basically with various groups, groups meaning like operations, airworthiness, survivability. And when each one of those groups are finished with their report and the reports reach 51%, our policy is to open that public docket.
He says the more than 400 pages of documents released do not include speculation on the cause of the crash.
We're not at a point where we're drawing any conclusions at this point. That will be addressed in detail during the when the probable cause is released. Probable cause will probably be following in the next probably 3 to 4 months or so.
The findings include a weight and balance study with 6 possible scenarios. It's noted that the precise weight and balance of the airplane during the flight can't be accurately determined with the limited data available. But the scenarios were constructed using the data that is known and, quote, logical documented assumptions. Johnson says the NTSB used known facts and evidence like a cell phone video taken by one of the passengers to put together the scenarios.
Basically what it is, in a nutshell, it's a factual account of everything that was found during the investigation. Each one of these reports are broken up or are studies that were done, again, from either operations, airworthiness, onboard video, which was captured during the accident, and then also performance reports. And that's basically what we're looking at this point right now.
Airplanes are tested and certified to have a maximum safe amount of weight. For the Otter, the max gross weight was 8,000 pounds. One of the unknowns is the amount of fuel on board the plane, which could change the weight. The owner of the Bear Mountain Lodge had also estimated the weight of the lodge supplies at about 300 pounds. The study finds there was about 613 pounds on board. In 2 of the scenarios, the Otter could have been overweight by about 20 to 40 pounds. In the other 4, the plane could have been safely under the max by anywhere from 40 to 2,000 pounds. But airplanes do have a safety buffer. It's not stated whether or not that potential overage could have seriously contributed to the crash. Another potential contributing factor is the center of gravity, or CG. CG is important because it helps keep the airplane stable in flight. If the center of gravity is off, it can make the plane harder to control and can make it difficult to compensate when problems arise. According to the weight and balance study, in 3 of the scenarios, the CG was too far back by a significant amount. In the other 3, it was in a safe range. In layman's terms, if the CG was toward the back of the plane would have been tail heavy. Extra weight in the back can push the nose of the plane up, and when the nose of the plane reaches a certain angle, it can result in a stall. Again, there is no definitive cause of the crash, but in speaking with some pilots who are familiar with the incident, they say a stall after takeoff could be a possibility. The plane crashed shortly after takeoff. There was a fire after the crash. The victims of the crash were two families from Greenville, South Carolina. They were Chris and Stacy McManus and their two children, and Milton and Kimberly Antonakis and their three children. The pilot was longtime aviator Walter Radisky. Radisky Air was contacted but declined to comment for this story. In Homer, I'm Shady Grove Oliver.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, Alaska's pipeline to the future, delivering oil today, sustaining operations for tomorrow. Craig Taylor Equipment Company, an authorized John Deere dealer. The Anchorage location just behind the Ship Creek Salmon Fishing offers a wide range of John Deere compact tractors. CraigTaylorEquipment.com. And by Wells Fargo, proud supporter of APRN and dedicated to helping people reach their goals on and off the field. Wells Fargo, together we'll go far.
Senator Lisa Murkowski, along with beer makers around the country, is celebrating a recent clarification from the Food and Drug Administration about spent grains. The material is a byproduct of the brewing process. Beer makers often donate their spent grains to farms to use as animal feed. But proposed changes to the rules for animal feed producers had brewers fearing they were going to face a pile of new red tape. Murkowski, who, in addition to being Alaska's senior senator, is co-chair of the Senate Brewers Caucus, took up the cause. In a sternly worded letter to the FDA in April, she said the rules would destroy the symbiotic relationship between Alaska's brewers and farmers. But the FDA has been saying for months it was all a mistake. The agency says it never meant to apply the animal feed rule to breweries. That's now spelled out in the rule. Murkowski, in a written statement today, said she appreciated the FDA's new approach. Academics and researchers have been meeting in Anchorage to bring together studies looking at what sustainability means in the Arctic. Andrei Petrov is lead investigator and director of Arctic Frost. He has studied the Arctic in Russia, Canada, and Alaska for 15 years. He says there is a lot of discussion about environmental changes, but social changes in Arctic communities can be even more dramatic. His work looks at human capital and community innovators.
Because the innovators, people who have new ideas, whether it's a business idea, technological idea, or maybe cultural idea, these are the people that I think are sort of enablers of, if you will, sustainable development in the Arctic. Because, you know, and Alaskans, I guess, would not let me be wrong in that saying that, you know, one or two people who really have great idea for their community could really change all everything around. And we see that in Canadian North, we see that in even in Russian North, in very difficult institutional conditions when entrepreneurship is very difficult. I mean, it's still the main force. I mean, you have to have, you can have government subsidies on oil. These are all important, but really the future of development in the Arctic is in its people and its capacity that people have. Because even if you have oil money, if you don't have a way in which you invest them smartly, that's going to be gone, right? So that's I think, one of my big lessons as well. You know, if you want to invest in Arctic, invest in its people.
Are there things that you've observed in your years of researching these communities and who the innovators are, that they've also addressed these ideas of not only just how can we take advantage of this, but how can we carefully proceed to make sure that we maintain the integrity of who we are as Arctic communities and not have that get lost in the advent of new development and a McDonald's coming in or those sorts of things?
What I say the main purpose of my work and the work of my colleagues, I think, is to look at the ways in which development, the capitalist economy, if you will, could be reconciled with traditional society. And that's from kind of formulating from kind of scientific standpoint. But this, on the other hand, from community standpoint, that's the also the most important question of the modern times. How do we do that? I mean, there is no recipe, unfortunately, but as I said, there are things that we know could work. These negotiations, right? You know, development is an option. So, and it's an option that opens to community. Community should consider whether they want it or not. And, you know, be prepared to deal with it. I mean, I guess in the Arctic, like in many other regions, resource regions, when development comes, we already should start thinking on what happens when it ends. And that is not always done because we always say, oh, well, it's going to be here forever. It's not going to be here forever. So how can we start planning for the end of this even before it starts? Maybe that's actually the important thing to do.
The science community clearly gets the need in the Arctic and the vast needs for study and collaboration on research and making those comparative studies. Mm-hmm. But what about the political dynamic here? You're in Iowa. Do people in Iowa, do political leaders in Iowa really get that we're an Arctic nation and that they need to be educated about these issues and that these are important? What's your sense of the political context here? Because that's an important component of this.
Well, I think we don't need necessarily go to Iowa. We can first go to Washington, D.C. And unfortunately, I always say that, you know, the United States does not understand itself as an Arctic nation. Yeah, and, oh, yeah, we have Alaska. Yeah, sure. But, you know, it's one state and it's somewhere in 700,000 people live there. Well, yes, unfortunately, that's not the case that we understand ourselves as an Arctic nation in contrast to almost every other. Russia, Canada, Iceland, I mean, they all think of themselves as the Arctic nations. At the same time, I think lately we see significant shifts, even this year, right? We have important appointments that the president made in terms of people who would be advising on Arctic policy, and there is a special envoy for the Arctic first time. So from that perspective, I think we're kind of moving in the right direction, but we're very far away.
Andrei Petrov is the lead investigator and director of Arctic Frost, a consortium of researchers studying sustainability in the rapidly changing Arctic. And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. You can also follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Dacia Eaton and Ben Matheson in Bethel, Joe Vicknicki in Petersburg, Ann Hillman in Anchorage, Mike Mason in Dillingham, and Shady Grove Oliver in Homer. APRN's Liz Ruskin reported from Washington, D.C. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Monica Goki is our web producer, and I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
ConocoPhillips, investing in oil and gas production and creating jobs and business opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company.
The Medallion Foundation and the Federal Aviation Administration set standards for the operation of aircraft and airports and provide services to the flying public. Passengers are influential in making flying safer in Alaska. When passengers know their rights and responsibilities, aviation is safer for everyone. Safety information online at faa.gov/go/flyalaska. This message is sponsored by the Medallion Foundation.
Alaska Native elders are 5 times more likely to be injured in a fall, but there are simple ways for elders to reduce fall-related injuries. Get an eye exam every year. Stay informed about medications that can cause dizziness. Exercise regularly to increase strength and balance, and keep your home clutter-free. This message sponsored by the Alaska Native Tribal Health Consortium.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.